Great. Thanks so much, Janet. Thanks, everybody. Welcome back after our lunch break. So before lunch, people were asking about the photos again. So I'll share my pictures again for those of you who weren't there when we started. And here we go. All right. So this is what it looked like. This is what I looked like. This is my recovery journey. This was what it looked like to be in the grips of this fatal progressive patient disease, right? And so there's pictures of me, variety of years, always getting larger. Sometimes I got smaller, always regained. Here as well, more photos. I often share about this leopard shirt. That was about all that fit me at that point. And here's what it looks like to live in the solution, right? And the wonderful thing is that I've been this size now for a number of years, and every single one of those dresses fits me, and I don't have to try them on to know that. They just do. And that is nothing short of a miracle, really. So that's it for my photos. My name is Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater, and I'm going to talk to you guys more about alcoholism. So I love this chapter. And I love how the chapters are presented, because each one puts you directly in the next one. Like, it leads you exactly into the next chapter. And so it's interesting. Why do we go from there's a solution to now, here, let me tell you more about the problem, right? And it's important, you know, it's really important. And I say this chapter could be called more about how we're crazy, right? Or even better, more about why we need a higher power, right? That's why I need to know more about this. And this chapter goes through story after story. And in each story, what's happening is that the doors that we thought might be the way out get closed for us, and they get locked. So that at the end of the chapter, we're left with only one possible way out. We're left with only one door, and that's the door to a higher power, right? And so there's no mistake that as this chapter ends, it's gonna repeat that, and then it's gonna put us right into We Agnostics so that we can meet that higher power. Okay, so now let's jump into this chapter. Page 30, first paragraph, tells us what our great obsession is. And no, it's not food. How's that? We think it's food. We think it's alcohol. No, the great obsession is that somehow, someday he will control and enjoy his drinking. For us, his eating. It's the great obsession that I'm going to be able to enjoy it and control it. And that this persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. So one of our biggest problems is that we don't think we have a problem. That's the biggest problem. In fact, we're persistent about keeping up this illusion. You know, despite the difficulties we live, we continue trying to prove the false idea. You know, got a name we all know well, it's called denial. We just keep denying. We're looking for a way that we're not quite as bad as the next person. I hear those questions all the time. I don't do it like that. That's part of the disease. Okay, so now the second paragraph tells us the first step to getting well. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. Delusion that we are like other people presently maybe has to be smashed, destroyed, unable to be put back together again, right? Not just broken, smashed, put it on the ground, crunch it with your foot and grind it in a little bit. We have to know this. We got to admit it, you know, diagnose ourselves. The diagnosis has to come from ourselves. This is why we don't try to convince others that they have a problem. We let the disease do the convincing. In fact, we're told somebody thinks they don't have it. We're given some suggestions later on what they should do. to find out if in fact they do, because each person has to know inside 100% if they've got this. Okay, the third paragraph tells us some characteristics of the disease: permanent and progressive. No alcoholic ever recovers control. We're in the grip of a progressive illness. It gets worse, never better. So, you know, for me, my own experiences, my binges got longer. They required more food. They were more frequent. The time in between was harder to tolerate. That period of going from binge to binge, it was more and more uncomfortable. You know, there was a time when I was, I would say junior high, right? I had a group of these girlfriends and we used to get together on Friday nights and we would have pig out parties. We used to love to binge together. We'd get a pizza, we'd get cupcakes, we'd get chip, all the regular stuff, right? And they would binge too. They would binge too, but it came to a point for me where I could not contain it to those Friday nights anymore. Nor could I stop when my friends fell asleep. They would all fall asleep sick to their stomachs and I would still be eating more, right? That's what happens with this disease. You know, first I tried to fit the binging into my life, right? And then I try to fit my life into my binging. And then what happens is I have no life. My life is binging. That's what becomes my life. So, okay, now page 31, the second paragraph, begins to list the methods. Methods are what we use to manage and control the disease. They're also what we use to support our delusional thinking that we can control this. And for most of us, the methods are diets. That's what we use. We use diets, weight loss, you know, weight control plans, gym memberships, insane exercise, you know, routines and regimes. And, you know, it's a good idea to list your own methods. And what amazes me when I look at my own is how many I've tried. How many different methods I've tried and how many I didn't just try, but I retried over and over and over again. And for me, it shows that lack of desire was never my dilemma. I always wanted it, nor was lack of information. I had great information. I wanted very much to stop. I knew precisely what foods were problematic. All of these methods, by the way, every single method I tried was extremely effective so long as I followed them. Right? If weight loss was my goal, every diet worked until the day it no longer worked. And then it never worked quite as well again. Right? And I say, you know, I'm going to bring back another dog analogy. I love my dog analogies. But for me, a diet is like trying to put a dog in the fenced yard and it finds the way out of the fence. And I just keep trying to put it back in that same yard. I'm just going to put it back in that same yard. And you can't keep putting him back inside that old yard with the same fence. Diets are like trying to fence the dog, right? So bottom of page 31 to the top of the next page, it gives us a way to diagnose the illness. Remember, we have to fully concede. So we need some strategies for diagnosis, for diagnosing ourselves. Can you control your eating? Can you eat the foods that are problematic in moderation, right? Can you do this consistently, right? So I might be able to moderate it right now, but can I consistently over a period of time moderate it? You know, and sometimes what's confusing is some people will say, but I don't binge. Okay, do you graze? Because that just means you're eating, but you're eating all day long. Right? And that's not moderation. Moderation is not having to have something in your mouth 24 hours a day. So for me, there was a period of time where I wasn't eating food compulsively, but I constantly had something in my mouth. For me, it was gum. I had a serious gum addiction, like a troubling gum addiction. My mouth constantly had to keep going. And I could lose a lot of weight during that period of time. So I couldn't look at my physical body and say, well, I'm thin now. If I was constantly chewing, then I have a problem. That's compulsive, right? And, you know, and so by the time we get here, most of us know the answer. Most of us come in because the experiment was a disaster, right? That's why we come here. You know, if I could have, I would have. I would have found other ways. By the way, I love you guys, but I would have found other ways to spend my Saturdays. I would have, right? If I could have done it, I know. Sorry, Janet, except for with you. And thank God I have this problem, because what could be better than spending my days with all of you, right? But that's not how I felt initially. So the chapter is going to give us four examples to help us determine some things and to bring to life some important concepts. And it's going to do it through four people. One is going to be the man of 30. Two is going to be Jim. Three, the jaywalker. And four is going to be Fred. So let's now look at the man of 30, bottom of page 32. This is an example, an excellent example of this, of a characteristic of this disease called patient. The disease is patient. You know, he had stopped drinking 25 years. He remained bone dry, it says. I want to like drill down on that, bone dry. Clearly, he had exceptional willpower. Clearly, he had self-discipline. And what's important to point out in this story, as well as the other ones we're going to discuss, is this man of 30 did not accidentally trigger an allergy, right? That is not what happened. He didn't accidentally consume something that set him up. Nope. It says he was bone dry. He wasn't being careless about what he was consuming. You know, in fact, that's very clear. You know, that's to say, in our terms, he was entirely abstinent, and for 25 years. So we know that entire abstinence is not an insurance, and it's not protection, nor is years of self-discipline. We cannot make up our minds and rely on our minds to stay made up. And if we're addicted, we cannot regulate and control. We found that out in his story too. You know, and so I have my honeymoon is a perfect example. When I met my husband, I had been abstinent a number of years already. I met my husband, I had come to Overeaters Anonymous, I got a food plan. It was clear of all my alcoholic binge foods. It was a clean plan. And it served me well, but I did not do much other than that. I really didn't. I didn't work with others. I was, in fact, as soon as I lost the weight I wanted to lose, I said bye and I left. And then I used some willpower, and it got me far enough, right? Got me far enough. And then I went on my honeymoon. And what happened to me is just like what happened to this man. Although I didn't last 25 years, for me, it was more like five. Went on my honeymoon. And I had something, I had a frozen tropical drink, and like that, that was it. It was like I could have marked it. I was abstinent, and then I drank, and everything went out the window. And the rest of my honeymoon was spent like sitting at a pool bar. And I loved my husband. I wasn't trying to like sabotage, nothing like that. It was, I thought I was normal. I had years of being abstinent gave me the ability to control and manage like everyone else. And I looked around, right? And then just like this man, right? So I went off on a crazy binge that honeymoon, which was seemed normal then too. Lots of people overeat and overindulge on a vacation. We had the best time doing that, right? Here's the problem. Gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could pass at his disposal, and every attempt failed. And what happened for me was that I had this food plan. I knew it well. And I came home that Monday certain that I could get right back on, and I couldn't. I couldn't. couldn't do it, that it was gone. So what's the lesson here? What's the lesson we get from him? If we're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. One day at a time in our program. We mean we live in freedom each day. We follow direction each day, but I don't believe that today I have this problem and tomorrow I won't. That's not one day at a time. It means that I can live in the solution one day, just today, and tomorrow, hopefully I can repeat that, right? Okay, so now page 34, the middle of the first paragraph. You're questioning whether you've entered this dangerous area, right? What area? The area where you're unable to quit your own willpower. They say, try leaving it alone for a year. This is another, in fact, powerless. Finding this out, not so much when we're having fun, right? When it's fun and we don't stop, we don't find out, but we find this out when we want to stop and we cannot, right? So I didn't really find it out when I was on my honeymoon. I was having a great time. I found it out on the Tuesday when I started it on Monday, and by Tuesday I was back in the food again, right? I was home to two. I was powerless when I tried to exert all of my power that I couldn't do it. From to more about alcoholism is going to try to help us determine if we can quit on our own, or if in fact someone, you know, if in fact we're someone who is going to require something beyond human power. And it's going to do this by describing the mental states. So on page 35, the mental states that a relapse into is part, right? That's what the crux, essential component, the moving part. And what is it? It's our thinking. We have faulty thinking. And it's going to, you know, do this now with three examples: Jim, the jaywalker, and Fred. So Jim, page 35, he was smart. He was likable. He had a beautiful family. He inherited a business, and yet his drinking was destroying it all. He was motivated to stop and was told about alcoholism, and he made a start, meaning he started on the road to recovery and his life started getting better again. But here's the important part. This is what we can learn from him. He failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And if there's any point that must be driven home, it's that we must have a spiritual life. We have to live spiritually, and it must continue to grow. Remember that this disease is permanent and it's progressive. And so my solution, which we had been told in the chapter that came before, that is a spiritual solution. My spiritual life must grow as well. I also want to drill the point that when Jim picked up, he was not dropped and he wasn't cast aside. And the reason he picked up was not because he triggered the allergy. That is not what happened. And like the man of 30, he was sober when he picked up. He picked up because he was not safe and protected. He had not enlarged his spiritual life. Bottom of page 35 says he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. So they worked with him, meaning he was working too, you know, and it's hard. I have to tell you, it's hard and it's uncomfortable when you're working with someone and they pick up. That's the most difficult part, really, when you're helping somebody. It's frustrating, you know, and especially when people eat again, right? And we know he got drunk again. So what did they do, right? What was that hard work they did? They asked him to tell us exactly what happened. And this is what we're supposed to do when a sponsee picks up. You know, don't just let them say, well, I ate off my plan, right? I don't want to talk about it. I picked up the food last night, but today I'm going to start. And yeah, no, no, mm-mm. We are actually told, ask him exactly what happened. You know, we actually press them for the details. We push the details with us. Why? Because we're trying to help them discover what happened, where they fell off track. So let's do this with Jim, right? Let's use this as an opportunity. He had words with his boss. That's what happened, right? He had a resentment. He was upset. He went to a bar to get lunch and a customer, right? He was already in trouble. He needed to do anything other than that. You know, we can say he was off track well before he went to that bar, well before. And our text tells us, by the way, that we can go anywhere provided we're in fit spiritual condition. And he wasn't. We're also told he failed to enlarge and perfect his spiritual life. So he wasn't in fit spiritual condition. And we also know how to get spiritually fit through work and self-sacrifice. Well, if he wasn't helping anyone, then I would say he was still in the hospitalization period. And we talked about that in the doctor's opinion. He doesn't belong in a bar, right? Just like early on in recovery, especially when I'm resentful, it is not a good idea for me to sit in Dunkin' Donuts having coffee, thinking I'm going to conduct any kind of business, right? That would be insane, insane. He wasn't fit. He didn't belong there. You know, he's sitting there having sandwich after sandwich, right? Milk after milk. And here's where it gets clear that Jim has an alcoholic mind. Top, middle of page 36. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk, and I vaguely sensed I was not being too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. Remember, Janet shared with us and before that we cannot rely on our memory, right? So that bridge, here's a perfect example. His bridge was broken because that thought was hazy. It wasn't clear, you know? So this is an example of foolish thinking. We cannot rely on our thinking. That's what we're told. We lie to ourselves and we believe it. And of course we believe the lie we tell ourselves because we've created it. We've created a lie that who needs to believe? That we need to believe. Right? So it's like that catch 22, bottom of page 36, top of page 37. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. His reasons for drinking were easily pushed inside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. You know, and now the next couple of sentences are going to help us to define insanity. And it says, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. Here's the definition: a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. How can that be called anything else, right? So insanity, for the purposes of our disease, means we lack proportion. And if you lack proportion, you minimize the importance of certain things and you make other things more important than they need to be. You know, so for me, what does that look like, right? Wanting ice cream because my throat hurts, right? Like my throat hurts so much. Let me eat ice cream, right? Because the throat hurting, right, proportionately, in my mind, in my insanity, is more of a problem than being over 300 pounds, right? Of having dangerously high blood pressure, right? Of the doctor saying you're not going to make it out of your 40s. I don't know many women that died of a sore throat. right? But I know women that died of obesity, right? So I lack proportion. I have no ability to think straight. You know, here's another thing that I've lacked proportion. In my illness, right, I would be invited to people's homes and I did not have the ability to ask either what's being served, right? Because proportionately, I'm more afraid of offending them or looking a certain way to them than I am about my own health and well-being. That means I lack proportion, because proportion is more important than my own health, right? Okay, so, and there's lots of other ways that we lack proportion, right? Many other ways. Now, the middle of page 37 describes how consequences and sound reasoning are not able to help us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check, and the insane idea went out. So I love visuals, right? And I envision this like a race, right? And it's me, right? Sound reasoning, the part of me that has sound reasoning versus the insane idea, right? And they run neck and neck, parallel, right? Neck and neck and neck and neck. And then when propelled on only my own human power, I am no match for the insane idea. That insane idea always wins the race. It outruns me. It's a patient adversary. Remember that man of 30, patient. This insane idea can run a marathon. It runs the long haul, right? It can wait 25 years to overtake. Page 38, the jaywalker. What does this teach us, right? What is this crazy idea about running in front of moving traffic, right? You would expect it if he were normal to cut it out, right? Cut it out. What are you doing? Stop eating like that. Are you crazy? Okay, we're not normal, right? That's the point. And we also learn that promises don't work, because he makes promises, nor does being ridiculed, right? You know, if you think that I wasn't ridiculed, right? Of course I was. I gained 100 pounds in high school. Ridicule would have worked. It would have worked. It didn't work. It doesn't work, right? Normal people can generally make promises and keep them, right? I could about other things, but not about this. You know, we compare this to the doctor's opinion, where recovered people's words are reliable, right? Meaning we can keep our word. When we're recovered, we can make promises and we can honor them, but not so with those who are still in the clutches of the illness, because the illness, you know, we're overwhelmed. The illness owns us. We're overwhelmed. Okay, page 39, the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. We'll read about Fred to illustrate this point, right? Fred's having a beautiful life, happy home, great marriage, promising kids, successful in business, and well-liked. Everyone likes him. So you don't have to be living a visible mess, right? You can have all these beautiful things in your life. You can present quite well, and you can have no other notable problems. But Fred wound up in the hospital. Although he was embarrassed by what had happened to him, he didn't even admit that he had a problem at all. Remember, he didn't fully concede. In fact, it said that he was there to rest his nerves. He thought he was there to rest his nerves. Like, denial, right? He was depressed about his drinking, so he felt bad about his drinking. Well, I've been depressed about my weight. I've been depressed about how much weight I've gained, how things didn't fit me. Being upset about your weight gain does not mean that you've taken step one, right? And so what happened? He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. He didn't believe he was an alcoholic. No step one, right? No step one. And he did not have step two for sure because he didn't accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. Well, why would you? There's no reason to accept a spiritual remedy from a problem unless you believe that you really have a problem that requires a spiritual remedy, which is why so much of the book is devoted to making sure that we understand exactly what our problem is, right? Top of page 40, he was positive that this humiliating experience plus the knowledge he acquired would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. Okay, well, we all know that was a failure for him, right? And we're also told that everything went great with him for a while, right? And not only went great for him for a while, but the time he picked up, everything was going great. And it doesn't say that he was sabotaging himself. Those were some of the things that people would say to me. That's maybe a psychological approach. We don't have a psychological approach. We have a spiritual approach. So that notion of self-sabotage, I'm ruining my own happiness, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I really believe I always wanted to be happy. I don't believe that I was setting out to destroy my life. He exercised willpower and thought he could stay on guard. So here's what I want to say about willpower. It's an unreliable power source for us. It has an expiration date, right? That's what I want to say. Willpower has an expiration date. All of a sudden, it's no longer available, right? And it's not like the carton of milk with an expiration date. Like you go in your fridge, there's a carton of milk. It's got the expiration date on it. You can predict when it's going to expire. It's not like that with willpower. All of a sudden, it's not there. And it's not there when I need it most of all. It's suddenly gone, right? And the problem with staying on guard is, well, it's the same thing as when we lie to ourselves, right? Who are we lying to when we lie to ourselves? We lie to ourselves. Who creates the lie? We do. Who has to believe it? We do. Therefore, we can't, right? We can't trust our thinking. Okay, here's the problem with staying on guard. Who's the guard? If I'm staying on guard, I'm the guard. It's like putting the wolf in charge of a picnic basket, right? I can't be the one on guard. And what I used to do is I used to assign other people in my family to be the guard, right? So I would say, don't let me eat this. Please don't let me eat this. Whatever you do, don't bring it in the house. Don't bring it in the house. Okay, that doesn't work either, because what would happen is I would eat it. I would go out and eat it, right? Here's me. I would make everybody throw everything out in this house, right? It's Monday morning. Get it all out. Don't you dare bring it in. Don't do it. If you love me, you won't, right? I made all these things they had to do for me. Everybody had to get rid of it. Tuesday, I'm sneaking eating it someplace else, right? And not only am I sneaking eating it someplace else, but please don't catch me. And then eventually I reach a point where I can't even hide it anymore and I'm bringing it in the house. And now don't even say anything about it to me. Like if you said anything, it would be war, right? I would turn it right back on you. You don't love me for who I am. We make these people crazy. They say, nothing makes a family as neurotic as living with an addict. We set themselves up. They don't know where they stand with us, right? So I want to say something else. It is never my family's responsibility to do anything to keep me recovered at all. They do not have to be concerned about what I can eat. I do. That's my job. Right? That's my role. That's my job. And even today, I would say, my husband loves me. And sometimes he'll say, well, really? Like, really, really, you can't have this? Like, you know, like if I'm like, can you look at the ingredients? Like he made one time this pot of soup, whatever. And I asked him to make it. We didn't look at the ingredient. Turns out it had it in it. Okay. And he's like, really? And of course he was annoyed by that. He lived with me so many years where, you know, you couldn't rely on what I said. Doesn't mean that I eat it to please him any longer, right? Those are two separate things, but I can't be upset with him for not understanding. It's okay. It's okay. It's my job to understand. All right. So now let's go back. I'm going to come back to this, to the text in the middle of page 41. Fred is describing that experience of crossing the threshold into the dining room. And he thinks that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. And it's so similar to a story to me that's told in the chapter, A Vision for You. And I just love like the difference between what happens when Fred is about, you know, when Fred is going into a place to where in A Vision for You, where Bill has a similar thought. You know, perhaps he could handle, say, three drinks or no more, right? Bill instead, and here's the difference, right? Bill actually, his business deal didn't go well. He had like every reason, right, to drink, every reason. But instead, what did Bill do in that chapter? He recoiled and he made a call looking for someone he could help. So he enlarged his spiritual life, right, through self-sacrifice and working with others. And that's what kept him safe and protected. But Fred did not, right? So Bill, who had a business deal go south, did not drink. And Fred, whose business went off well, he did drink. Right? He did drink. And it says again, not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. And here's a part of the insanity. We truly cannot protect ourselves from danger because the things that are dangerous to us seem harmless, right? Why would you think you'd need to protect yourself from ginger ale, right? It's ginger ale. It seems harmless. Just like I would think, why would I need to protect myself from soup that my husband made for me, right? Or why would I need to protect myself from ice cream? My throat hurts, right? It's just at that point, it seems medicinal, right? Medicinal. So I can't tell what's harmless. And I'm going to just kind of drill down on that because I did share with you guys that like part of my problem was I had this, for me, like I've had this issue with gum of all things, right? Something so harmless. And but it was a problem for me, my own personal experience. Not everybody has that, but I do. And I did it in a way that I hurt my teeth and I hurt my jaw. And I didn't even know that it was such a big problem for me until I stopped. And other people would be like, at work all the time, people would come to my room and be like, do you have any gum? Like everybody all day long is coming to my room asking me for gum. And I said at one point, I said, no, I don't. And the person went, you always have gum. I was like the gum pusher for the building, right? Gum, how silly, how harmless, how could that look like anything, right? And so here's another way that I lacked proportion. I'm going to sort of bring that back in again. Because, right, thinking it's just like ginger ale. A few years ago, I was going to visit my mom in Florida. And just me by myself, it's like a yearly trip I always take. It's just me. I'm going to go see my mom. My mom's aging. So it's a little bit of sometimes a trying time. It's like totally giving to my mom. I love her dearly, but sometimes it's difficult, right? And I'm in the airport and I decide I'm going to buy gum. Now, I've been abstinent and free of gum for a number of years, but I bought it. Bought two packs of gum. But not one, two packs. I'm going to need two packs. I didn't put it in my mouth. Somehow, like Bill, right? he picked up the phone and called someone, right? I did the same thing. I texted someone and I shared with them the crazy thought that had just come in my head. And this person said to me, and it was so helpful. She said, at what altitude do you lose your problem with gum? Like, is there a certain altitude you reach in the sky where you don't have that problem anymore? And I was like, oh my God, no. You know, I was like, oh, that's, you're right. That's crazy. And I said, no, I guess you're right. I guess I'm going to have to suffer with an earache, right? Because in my mind, I'm going to have an earache. And then she said something else that I just think is so important that the chapter winds up driving home. She said, better question, at what altitude do you lose your connection with God? And I thought, oh, that's right. That's right. I don't have to worry about an earache, right? Why would I worry about an earache? I've got a loving creator, right? Who's going to help me. Maybe I'll get an earache, but he'll certainly be by my side. Now, the wonderful part of the story is I threw the gum in the garbage and I sent her the picture and I don't think I had an earache. If I did, it was not memorable. I was able to fly without an ear. So, okay. So for me, that's what it means to not be able to see what's harmful and what's harmless. Okay. On the top of page 42, it's repeated again, willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. At this, Fred is crushed. Now, when two members come to see him in the hospital, they're smiling, right? They're happy. Why? We're not sadistic. We don't smile when people are crushed in the hospital. They're there to help. And we learned right in the beginning of this chapter, we can't help anybody until they fully concede, until they're crushed, until the idea that they can do it on their own is smashed, right? So I love how we're being shown exactly from this story how we carry the message as well. They asked him if he thought himself alcoholic and if he was licked. And when he said yes, they didn't start cheering him up right away. They didn't say, okay, yay, you're on your way. Mm-mm, nope. In fact, they didn't offer him hope right away. In fact, they told the truth about his condition, that it was hopeless, that his condition was hopeless. And they talked about their own sufferings. They just kept telling him stories about their own pain. They told their stories. And once Fred admitted that he couldn't do it on his own, then they outlined the spiritual answer. It was then that they began to give him the spiritual component. And we have to know that we're all out of options before being truly ready to accept the spiritual solution. Our solution requires throwing some lifelong conceptions out the window. You know, and what makes me think of this is how my set of directions from this program provides me with a new code and a new life structure and a purpose. And it's not easy to adapt a whole new set of guiding principles unless you're convinced that yours has led you to ruin, right? That's when you're willing to let go of your old way of living for this new one. And the bottom of page 42 to the top of 43, it's one of my favorite, I say it's promise of the book. Spiritual principles would solve all my problems, all of them, right? Not just my food problem, people, all of my problems. I've since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than the life I had lived before. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back even if I could. That's his experience and that's been mine as well. Every single problem I've experienced today can be solved through the spiritual solution, right? Through a spiritual course of action. The steps are my pathway to God, right? And that's what solves all my problems. If you told me tomorrow, I assure you, if you told me tomorrow that I could eat whatever I want and never have to do all these things I have to do to live in freedom from the food, I would flatly refuse the offer. I'm not interested in that anymore, right? My life is incredibly better for having been a compulsive overeater who has a solution. That really is the truth for me. I mean, look at it, like, you know, everything is better in my life today. I have friendship, fellowship, a way of living infinitely better, which means it's just going to continue to get better and better and better. And the bottom of page 43, once more, right? It's going to state this again. The alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So this chapter, like I said in the beginning, was going to show me all the doors that are closed to me. It's going to close them and lock them, right? This chapter closes and locks all the other doors. And it ends with the one door that's left available to me, right? It's the only thing that can save me is an act of providence. Like step one, which is in the AA 12 and 12, it says only an act of providence can relieve me. You know, an act of providence, a miracle of God's healing power. And so like I said earlier, that's the beautiful thing. As a chapter ends, it purposefully gives us the next step, right? The next step. And I love, if you think about taking steps on a staircase, right? If you do it correctly, there's a period where your foot is dangling. Your foot is here. And it's only natural to put it on the next one, right? To continue, to put it on the next one. And so that's where I'm going to leave you. Hopefully your foot is just ready to put it down on the next step. And with that, I will pass.